Welcome to the Revitalize My Church podcast, created to help churches navigate change and reorient to a new and healthy future. Here's the host of the show, Bart Blair.
This is episode 48 of the Revitalize My Church podcast. My name is Bart Blair. Welcome to the show. This is the 48th edition that we have produced over the course of the last 2 years, and our goal is to help churches navigate change and reorient to a new and healthy future. Thanks for tuning in. If you happen to be new to the show, we drop an episode on the 1st and the 15th of every month. This is the 15th of the month, the 15th of July of 2026. And it is a monumental day in the history of our show and our ministry. Today, on July 15th, 2026, a new book that Nathan Bryant and I have co-written together, I guess you'd say we co-authored, called The Five Big Rocks of Church Revitalization, is now available. Available on Amazon today, probably some other outlets in the upcoming weeks and months, but want to let you know that that is available. And today's episode is one that, well, I'll be honest with you, it's going to be a little bit different. Maybe you'll find it interesting, maybe not. I thought it was kind of interesting. There's a new AI tool called Google Notebook LM. And I was playing around in this thing, and I took the manuscript of our book right before we published it, and I threw the manuscript into Notebook LM and had it create an audio overview of the book. And what you're going to hear in this podcast episode is that AI-generated audio overview of our book. Now, granted, I'm just going to throw the caveat out there. This is AI generated. I think by and large, it captures pretty much the ethos of what we were trying to communicate in the book. But it is a little bit quirky because, well, it is AI generated. So give us a little bit of grace for that. I hope that you will find it somewhat amusing and perhaps entertaining. But most of all, I hope that it will help you get a great overview of what our book is about and how it might help you as a pastor or as a church leader. So I'll be back at the end of the little AI overview that you're about to listen to. And again, thanks for tuning in to the show.
There's a very specific, a quiet kind of heartbreak in walking into a church sanctuary that was clearly built for, you know, maybe 500 people.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And then you just find 40 or 50 scattered across the back pews. And I think the most startling part isn't even the empty seats.
Right. It's they've just gotten used to it.
Exactly. It's the realization that the congregation has somehow normalized the silence. I mean, they haven't seen a baptism in a decade. The nursery is basically doubling as a storage closet.
Yeah, full of old VBS supplies.
Right. And yet week after week, they just keep going through the motions. They're in this deep terminal decline. And the institutional inertia is so strong, they don't even realize the doors are closing.
It is, unfortunately, a very pervasive phenomenon. Countless congregations are, you know, functionally stuck on life support.
Yeah.
And the diagnostic landscape for why this happens is incredibly murky. You can't just run a quick audit and pinpoint, like, a single mechanical failure.
This is not a machine.
Exactly. You're dealing with generations of human emotion, deep-seated traditions, and just massive spiritual fatigue. It really requires a fundamental systemic overhaul from the ground up.
Which is exactly why we are doing this custom-tailored deep dive for you today.
Yeah.
We're pulling apart a framework from the book The Five Big Rocks of Church Revitalization.
By Bart Blair and Nathan Bryant.
Yes, from Assist Church Expansion. Mm. So our mission today is to thoroughly examine their biblical blueprint for, well, breathing actual life back into a declining church.
And the stakes really could not be higher for these communities. But what makes this text so compelling is its refusal to just accept that decline is inevitable.
Right.
The foundational premise of the book, and really the entire narrative of Scripture, is that God specializes in resurrection. I mean, making dead things live again is the core business of the gospel.
Okay, let's unpack this, because before we dive into the actual mechanics, we're setting a hard parameter for our discussion today.
Great.
The authors do use some secular analogies, like there's a whole parable about a general store that they weave in to illustrate their points. But we are bypassing all of that today.
Okay, skipping the business stuff.
Right. We are getting straight to the marrow of the spiritual renewal process, focusing exclusively on the biblical principles and the actual church dynamics.
And if we are looking at the absolute bedrock of those dynamics, it all starts with an invisible metric.
Okay.
Because before you can even entertain a conversation about new outreach programs or changing the service structure or drafting a strategic roadmap, you have to establish an unbreakable baseline of unity.
Because if you try to build a massive new strategic structure on a fractured foundation,
it crumbles.
Yeah, the sheer weight of the changes will just split the church in half.
Precisely. Brilliant strategy routinely collapses under the weight of internal division. But the authors are very careful to define how this unity is actually forged.
It's not just holding hands and singing.
Is that right? No, not at all. It is rarely a top-down mandate where a solo pastor simply declares a new direction. And it's almost never a grassroots movement that bubbles up from the pews without leadership buy-in.
So it has to be both.
It requires a collision of the two, starting at the very top.
So the primary leaders have to get their own house in order first.
Exactly. The elders, the deacons, the core staff, they have to lock themselves in a room and really just bleed out their fears.
Wow.
Yeah, they have to wrestle with incredibly uncomfortable questions about their own complicity in the decline. The text cites Amos 3:3 here. Can two walk together unless they are agreed?
Right.
They have to achieve a shared calling before they ever step up to a microphone to cast vision to the congregation.
And once that leadership core stops fighting each other and aligns, the text introduces this fascinating concept of the remnant.
The remnant, yes.
It's this small, fiercely loyal core of people still sitting in the pews. These are the folks who remember the church at its absolute peak, like 20 years ago.
Yeah, the glory days.
Right. And they're the ones who stubbornly refuse to let the lights go out during the leanest years.
They hold the institutional memory. And they have the most to lose, which paradoxically makes them the most powerful advocates for revitalization.
If you can get them on board.
Exactly, provided leadership can successfully mobilize them.
But the mechanism of that mobilization is so tricky. I was thinking about it like trying to thaw out frozen water pipes in an old house.
Okay, I like this.
If you take a blowtorch to a frozen pipe, meaning if leadership blasts the congregation with intense heat and tries to force sweeping cultural changes overnight, the thermal shock causes the pipe to burst.
You get a flood.
You get a massive flood of conflict, yeah. Thawing pipes requires slow, ambient, steady warmth.
That analogy maps perfectly onto the warnings in the text. I mean, the single most common fatal error leaders make in a turnaround is outrunning their congregation.
Moving too fast.
Yeah. You have to generate small, tangible wins to gradually warm that remnant up to the reality that change is actually safe.
But let me push back on the reality of that remnant for a second.
Okay, go for it.
What if that core group is just utterly exhausted? I mean, what if they've sat through three previous pastoral regimes that all promised a glorious turnaround and all three failed?
Yeah, that happens a lot.
How do you thaw out a congregation that has weaponized its cynicism as a defense mechanism?
What's fascinating here is how the authors address that exact deep-seated fatigue. The antidote they prescribe for institutional cynicism isn't like a flashier vision statement.
What is it then?
It is relentless over-communication and brutal transparency.
You just keep telling them the plan over and over.
You over-communicate the reality. You tell the story of where the church has been, where it currently is, and where it is headed. And you do not stop until the congregation can literally recite it back to you.
Wow. Okay.
And crucially, when you hit a wall or a strategy fails, you share that failure openly. A cynical congregation can handle bad news.
They're used to bad news.
Exactly. What they absolutely will not tolerate is being managed or kept in the dark. Transparency rebuilds that shattered trust. The authors anchor this in Psalm 133, which describes unity as this precious oil running down Aaron's beard.
Which is a messy image.
It's very messy. It's a slow-moving, covering presence that relies on patient, continuous prayer to re-energize a tired people.
So you've got the grueling work. The leadership is aligned. The remnant is starting to thaw out and trust again. You have a solid slab of concrete to build on.
Right.
But concrete doesn't move. You need a motor. You need someone to actually chart the course into the unknown.
You need a visionary leader, because a unified congregation without a clear, decisive voice at the helm will simply enjoy their newfound peace while drifting comfortably into obscurity.
They'll just be happy together while the ship sinks.
Exactly.
The authors don't just ask for a generic CEO type, though. They build a highly specific biblical profile for this role, pointing straight to Psalm 78's description of King David.
Yes. Heart in hand.
Yes. The text says David shepherded the people with an upright heart and guided them with his skillful hand.
It's a dual mandate.
Right.
The upright heart represents deep character, spiritual maturity, and the right motivation. Yeah. You know, loving the people rather than using them to build some personal empire.
Which we see too often.
Oh, way too often. But then the skillful hand represents high-level competency, strategic thinking, and execution. A revitalization leader cannot survive with just one or the other.
They need both.
And based on Ephesians 4, their primary function isn't to be a superhero doing all the ministry themselves. It's to equip the saints to do the work.
Here's where it gets really interesting to me, because there is a massive tension in that dual mandate.
How so?
Well, if a leader genuinely possesses an upright heart, if their fundamental wiring is pastoral care, comforting the sick, and loving their flock, doesn't that inherently war against the skillful hand required to ruthlessly dismantle beloved but broken church cultures?
It's a tough balance.
How does a leader avoid becoming a bulldozer under the guise of strategy?
It is a brutal tension to navigate, but the text frames true servant leadership through the lens of figures like Moses leading Israel out of Egypt or Nehemiah returning to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem.
Okay.
Biblical servant leadership is never about preserving the leader's comfort or just keeping the status quo happy.
So pastoral care doesn't mean keeping people comfortable in captivity.
Exactly the opposite. It is a profound, almost aggressive love for the church that compels the leader to force people out of their comfort zones because they know survival depends on it.
Wow.
The text warns that a visionary leader in a turnaround must develop an incredibly thick skin. Every strategic move will be criticized.
Oh, for sure.
Motives will be questioned by the very people the leader is trying to save. Some people will get angry and leave. But the mandate is to be a steward of God's church, not the manager of a country club. Leaders have to make the agonizing calls.
A thick skin, a strategic mind, and a pastoral heart. That is a heavy crown to wear, which is why I think it's a profound relief that the framework explicitly forbids the visionary leader from drafting the blueprints alone.
Yes, they can't do it in a vacuum.
Right. To turn that vision into a tangible reality, they have to assemble a highly specialized crew of architects.
Proverbs 15:2-2 states it plainly, "Without counsel, plans fail, but with many advisors, they succeed." The visionary cannot operate in an echo chamber. They need to construct what the authors call a vision team.
And to clarify for you listening, the text is adamant that this vision team is completely distinct from the permanent governing board.
Yes, very important distinction.
It is not the standing committee of elders or deacons. It is a temporary elite strike force of 5 to 8 people, handpicked by the visionary leader for their specific giftings, and their sole mandate is to formulate strategic recommendations.
They are brought in for a season to do heavy intellectual and spiritual lifting, and the framework identifies 6 distinct archetypes or roles that must be in that room to prevent blind spots.
Okay, so who do we have?
Well, you obviously have the visionary leader driving the bus, but you also need an administrator, someone who thrives on structure and can, you know, translate lofty ideas into actionable spreadsheets.
The person who actually gets things done.
Right. You need a shepherd, someone with a deep pastoral sensitivity who constantly asks, hey, how is this massive change going to affect the 85-year-old widow in the third row?
Vital question.
Then you need a gatherer, the charismatic glue who can rally the broader congregation, and a spiritually gifted teacher to ensure that the entire process remains strictly tethered to biblical truth.
And what was the last one?
The final archetype is the translator.
Now, this role caught my attention immediately. Because a traditional church mindset assumes everyone speaks the same language. So if you have a translator in the boardroom, how does that dynamic actually work against the instincts of, say, the shepherd?
Think about what the translator represents. They act as a cultural missionary to the immediate neighborhood outside the church's front doors. They understand the vernacular, the anxieties, and the specific socioeconomic realities of the unchurched people in a 2-mile radius.
They know the outside world.
Exactly. So while the shepherd is fighting to protect the comfort of the existing flock inside the building, the translator is fiercely advocating for the outsider.
Oh, I see. They create productive friction. The translator looks at a proposed Sunday morning structure and says, the people we are trying to reach don't understand the insider jargon you're using. They don't know when to stand up or sit down. you are building invisible barriers.
And that friction is the entire point of the vision team. If you just have visionaries, you get reckless change. If you just have shepherds, nothing ever changes because someone might get their feelings hurt.
Yeah, you stay paralyzed.
The translator forces the unchanging truth of the gospel into the current cultural dialect of the neighborhood, ensuring the team's strategies actually survive contact with reality.
So you lock this diverse, specialized team in a room. You have the tension, you have the data. What is the actual output? Like, what are they building? That brings us to the strategic plan itself.
And a lot of well-meaning congregations operate under this illusion that strategic planning is somehow unspiritual.
Like it's a lack of faith.
Right. That we should just pray and let the Holy Spirit spontaneously fill the seats. But the text argues fiercely that God himself is the ultimate strategic planner. Jesus highlights this in Luke 14, asking what kind of builder starts a tower without first sitting down to rigorously calculate the cost.
Hope is not a strategy.
It is not.
The roadmap this team has to build is structured around four relentless questions, the four W's. Why do we exist? Who are we currently? Who are we called to reach? And finally, who do we need to become to actually reach them?
Those four questions force the team to build a comprehensive pathway. They can't just brainstorm a cool marketing campaign. They have to plot exactly how a skeptic from the neighborhood will be welcomed at the door.
The whole journey.
Yeah, how they will be enfolded into a small group, what the explicit pathway for their discipleship looks like, and how they will eventually be equipped and released back into the community for ministry.
I want to zoom in on that fourth W because it feels like the tripwire for the whole process.
Yeah.
Who do we need to become?
Yeah, that's the hard one.
If a church has to fundamentally change who they are to reach the neighborhood, doesn't that inherently compromise their core identity? I mean, if you are contorting your culture just to attract a crowd, haven't you effectively lost your soul?
If we connect this to the bigger picture of church history, we see a critical distinction that answers your question. The authors issue a severe warning against altering anything theological.
Okay.
The gospel message, the authority of Scripture, the orthodox doctrines, those are fixed points. They do not bend to cultural whims.
But the packaging bends.
Yes. The tragedy of a dying church is that it almost always confuses its theology with its traditions.
Yeah.
The hard work of the vision team isn't figuring out how to dilute the gospel to make it palatable.
Right.
The agonizing work is holding up a mirror and asking, how much of what we are fiercely defending as biblical is actually just the cultural aesthetic of 1985?
Ouch. Yeah, that hits close to home for a lot of places.
It is deeply painful. Mm-hmm. But shifting service times, overhauling the musical style, redesigning the communication strategy, or tearing out the pews, these are not theological compromises.
They're just methods.
Exactly. They are strategic, necessary adaptations designed to remove human-made barriers to a divine message. You change the methods so the message can actually be heard.
So the team survives the boardroom, they navigate the friction, they separate the sacred theology from the outdated traditions, and they finalize a God-honoring plan.
Check.
The foundation is set, the engine is running, the roadmap is drawn. Now you actually have to pull the trigger.
And this is where the framework shatters the most pervasive misconception in church revitalization. When people hear the word launch, they immediately picture a grand opening Sunday.
Balloons, a banner over the door.
Right. A massive marketing push, a packed house, and then Monday morning, hey, you're a revitalized church. The text argues that the launch is absolutely not a Sunday. It is a season.
A sustained burn.
A concentrated, high-intensity season lasting anywhere from 6 to 12 months. And the biblical precedents the authors use are profound here.
Like what?
Look at the tabernacle in Exodus. God provided the blueprint. But before his glory filled the space, there was an excruciatingly long season of gathering materials, mobilizing skilled laborers, and meticulous construction.
A lot of sweat equity.
Tons. The culmination of the launch was built on months of unseen preparation.
The text also points to the early church in Acts. After the initial explosion of Pentecost, they didn't just high five and wait for the crowds to return the next weekend.
No, they got to work.
Yeah. They entered a dynamic, grueling daily season of preaching, breaking bread, and making disciples. It fundamentally changes the metaphor. It's not throwing a party. It's a NASA rocket launch.
I love that image.
Because when the public watches a shuttle go up, they only see the fire and the liftoff.
Hmm.
But 90% of a successful launch is the fueling, the systems checks and the engineering that happens in the agonizing months before ignition.
Exactly. A church might structure this season in 90-day sprints. You know, 90 days focused purely on community visibility, followed by 90 days optimizing the guest experience, followed by 90 days launching new small groups.
But this, I mean, how do they keep it up? With such a long season of high-intensity output, how do they survive it? A congregation that was recently on life support doesn't have the stamina for a year-long sprint. How do you prevent catastrophic volunteer burnout?
This raises an important question, though, because you can't just have the visionary leader carrying the entire structural weight on their back for a year.
Right. They'll break.
The authors provide two critical survival mechanisms for the launch season. First, the delegation of champions. Yeah. The visionary leader has to empower specific individuals to absolutely own distinct ministry areas, a champion for the children's ministry overhaul, a champion for guest services. But the second, and arguably more vital mechanism, is the relentless celebration of micro wins.
Micro wins. Because you're not going to see 500 people show up in month two.
Exactly. Turnarounds are a marathon played out in inches. The trough of sorrow usually hits around month seven when the initial adrenaline fades and the work just feels heavy.
Yeah, the honeymoon is over.
Right. To survive that, leadership has to publicize every tiny victory. If one new family checks a kid into the nursery, you celebrate it publicly.
Awesome.
If one skeptical neighbor attends a community barbecue, you highlight it. If one person steps into the baptismal waters, you throw a party.
You treat the micro wins as spiritual fuel.
Because they are proof of life. Those celebrations remind the exhausted volunteers that the grueling work of the launch season is actually producing a harvest, even if it's slow.
Man, we've covered a tremendous amount of ground. We have the underground foundation of unity, the dual mandate engine of the visionary leader, the productive friction of the vision team, the rigorous honesty of the plan, and the marathon season of the launch.
It's a lot.
It is. But as the authors bring this entire framework to a close, they pull the lens back from all the structural strategy and focus on the ultimate why. At the center of the blueprints and the friction is the human heart.
The afterword of the book anchors every single one of these principles in a specific encounter. Jesus and the Samaritan woman at the well, found in John chapter 4.
Yeah.
In that cultural context, Jewish travelers would literally add days to their journey to bypass the region of Samaria because of deep-seated ethnic and religious hostility. But Jesus walked directly into the tension. He specifically sought out an outsider, a woman isolated by her own brokenness and shame.
She represents the exact demographic a dying, inward-focused church has historically tried to walk around.
Yes. But the authors draw out a brilliant historical detail from that text. The well where Jesus offered this marginalized woman living water wasn't just a random hole in the ground. It was dug by their shared ancestor, Jacob, generations earlier.
Oh, wow.
Jacob did the back-breaking, unglamorous work of digging through rock and dirt, having absolutely no idea that centuries later, the Messiah would sit on those very stones to spark a spiritual awakening that would transform an entire town.
So what does this all mean for you listening? It means that true church revitalization isn't a growth hack. It's not a quick fix to manipulate Sunday attendance numbers and make the budget look better.
It's way bigger than that.
It is a generational legacy project. It is about doing the hard, painful, unglamorous work of digging wells in the dirt today so that future generations can drink the living water.
You dig the wells without demanding to know who will drink from them. Every uncomfortable elder meeting, every tradition you sacrifice for the sake of the mission, every micro win you celebrate during a brutal launch season, these are well-digging moments.
Which brings us full circle. We noted at the beginning that when a church is dying, the diagnostic landscape is murky. You can't just put the congregation in an x-ray machine and get a clean picture of what's broken.
No, you can't.
But maybe that murkiness is a feature, not a bug, because we're looking for the wrong kind of visibility. I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over today as you look at your own communities. If God specializes in bringing dead things back to life, and the grueling, thick-skinned work of revitalization is really about digging a well for a generation that hasn't even been born yet, what if the absolute deepest, most profound impact of your life's work is a harvest you won't even be around to see? You can't x-ray the future, but you can start digging.
Well, I don't know about you, I thought it was semi-entertaining and hopefully helpful for you. Again, we want to remind you that we drop an episode of this podcast on the 1st and the 15th of every month. So if you haven't yet subscribed wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts, make sure that you do that so that you don't miss any future episodes. Hey, and if you have any feedback about this little AI overview, whether you thought it was good, bad, creepy, or otherwise, feel free to leave a comment. You won't hurt my feelings. I know it is what it is. I just wanted to take a unique opportunity to let everyone know that this book, The Five Big Rocks of Church Revitalization, is now available. I hope that you will go and pick up a copy. Maybe you need a few copies to share with your leadership team. And if you do happen to read the book and you find it to be helpful, please leave a review of the book on Amazon. That'll help more people find it. Thanks again for tuning in. We'll see you next time.